Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the afternoon Dhamma talk from our one-day retreat at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 9th, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Bahia Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. Is everybody here? Is anybody missing? Speak up now.
Puppets in there. I think
everybody's here. Olivia, that's what got my attention. She is rather whimsical, isn't she? I think our schedule, the posted schedule, said that we're going to be concluding around 3 o'clock, and we will if that is important to any one of you. The reason why I'm saying that is if somebody has to leave, please let me know. And we'll conclude at 3 o'clock. I think doing a retreat, it's important that we finish the retreat together. So do we have to be done by 3, or can we go a little bit after? At 3 o'clock? Okay, that's what it'll be. Thank you for letting me know. Let me give the talk, the Bahia Sutta. It's a pretty quick sutta, and I think it's just appropriate for everything we've been talking about this week. It's not that long, but where is it? There it is. Just to kind of loosely tie this back into the theme of today and the theme of this week and our upcoming residential retreat of emptiness, when the Buddha talks about mindfulness, ultimately, what he's talking about is the ability to create that refined mindfulness that our mind is free of any ignorant thoughts. And he's teaching Bahia directly and very simply how to achieve that. So the Bahia Sutta tells the story of Bahia. Bahia was revered in his community as a person of great understanding. Let me put my clock on so I don't go too late. Bahia was revered in his community as a person of great understanding. One day in seclusion, Bahia entertained the idea of whether he was an arahant, an enlightened being, or was he lacking in some key understanding. In meditation, a female diva told him that he was not yet an arahant. In fact, his current practice did not have the qualities that could give rise to enlightenment. So in this case, and in all the... There's a lot of use of metaphor in the Pali Canon, and in this case, the diva is simply metaphor for a state of Bahia's consciousness. And it was often portrayed that way, that our states of consciousness were metaphorically attached to gods and goddesses and divas. If you remember the story of the Buddha's awakening, how Mara kept coming after the Buddha during meditation. Mara was metaphor for the Buddha's own consciousness. He asked the diva, or insight arose within him, if there was one in the world who knew the way to enlightenment. The diva told Bahia of the arahant, a rightly self-awakened one who teaches his Dhamma. The Buddha was in Savatthi at the time. Bahia immediately left to find the Buddha and learn the Dhamma. He came upon a group of monks and asked if they knew where to find the Buddha. The monks told Bahia that the Buddha was on his alms round. Bahia went into town and came upon the Buddha. Bahia, he feared impermanence and uncertainty and was concerned that he or the Buddha may die before he received the Dhamma. The Buddha was serene and at peace. Bahia placed himself at the Buddha's feet and asked, "Teach me the Dhamma, awakened one. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term benefit, my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." The Buddha replied, "This is not the time, Bahia. I am on my alms round." Bahia pleaded, "Awaken one, no one can know for sure the dangers there may be for you or for me. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." So Bahia had a pretty good understanding of impermanence, didn't he? And especially his own impermanence. A second time the Buddha responded, "This is not the time, Bahia. I am on my alms round." So, I mean, that's interesting to me, where the Buddha was not one who was given to just making sure everyone around him was happy. Meaning denying what he was doing and what he was focused on just to satisfy Bahia. Again, Bahia pleaded, "Awaken one, no one can know for sure the dangers there may be for you or for me. Teach me the Dhamma now for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." The Buddha realized it, the sincerity of Bahia's plea. And finally, the Buddha relented. I will teach you the Dhamma, Bahia. Listen carefully to my words. Train yourself in this manner. In what is seen, there is only the seen. In what is heard, there is only the heard. In what is sensed, there is only the sense. In what is cognized, only the cognized. That last line could be translated to say, whatever you think of what's occurring, that's what you're thinking of. It doesn't have to be any different. Whatever is cognized is only what's cognized. In what is seen, there's only the seen. I don't have to attach myself to what is being seen. I can look at something, no matter what it is, and be at peace with it without the need, meaning I can accept it without the need to approve it. There's no me there. I don't have to bring any of my morals, any of my political convictions, any of my wants or desires into what's seen. What is seen is only what is seen. What is heard, there is only what is heard. What is sensed is only what is sensed. The Buddha continues, this is how you should train yourself. When for you there is only what is there, in what is seen is only what is seen, in what is heard only the heard, in what is sensed only the sensed, and in what is cognized only the cognized. Then Bahia, there is no you in connection with what is seen, heard, sensed, or cognized. There is no you there. And of course, the Buddha is not talking about annihilation. He never was. He's simply saying there's no self-referential views when you're seeing things clearly, when you're sensing things clearly, when you're hearing things clearly, when you're thinking clearly. It's absence. It's empty of self-referential views. There is no you there. The Buddha continues, when there is no you there, you are neither here nor there nor anywhere in between. What does that mean? It means that as a human being, he's no longer projecting himself into the future and future situations, which might be just the next future moment or next year or the next 100 years, and he's not stuck in the past. He's not here or there. He's fully present. I'm going to go back that one sentence. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor there nor anywhere in between. This and only this is the end of stress and unhappiness. What he's saying is to be fully present with what's occurring in your life. This and only this is the end of stress and unhappiness. Upon hearing the words of the Buddha, Bahia's mind cleared. Clinging and grasping, greed and aversion ended, and all self-referential views were extinguished. Bahia awakened. These are my words now. It is by being fully present with dispassionate mindfulness that we are able to truly see our attachments. In this brief sutta, in this brief teaching, the Buddha taught Bahia to put aside all views of self arising from confused and deluded thoughts based on clinging and craving. To truly understand any problem, the problem must be observed clearly, without discriminating thought and without a view of self attached to what is observed. That means that's what the Buddha did when he observed suffering clearly. And then he understood it. This includes the immediate and mundane problems of the ever-changing physical world and the individual and immediate problem of the distraction of stress and unhappiness. Any questions about... Yes?
Did he just go back to say before the Buddha awakened he could feel the distraction?
Let me say that paragraph then too. To truly understand any problem, the problem must be observed clearly, without discriminating thought and without a view of self attached to what is observed. So remember the Buddha set out trying to understand the nature of suffering. Where does it come from? How does it arise? Why is it a part of our world? And upon his awakening, his mind cleared and he was finally able to see the problem of suffering clearly. And he understood then that the overarching disappointing nature was inherent in human life. Nothing we can do about that. But then he also understood his own contribution to that, which was craving for things to be different, more or less of something, and clinging to that identity that he created over those needs, the second noble truth. So what an important question you asked. Thank you. Is that clear, what I just said to everybody? Because it really is, it's what the Buddha awakened to, it's what he's telling Bahia, and it's what Bahia got. Now, also understand that Bahia is not hearing this in a vacuum. He has also listened to the Buddha's teachings in the past and other teachers, or he wouldn't be so confused. But.
Just in what the Buddha said to Bahia, in that when you can what's heard is only what's heard, when what's seen is only what's seen, what's cognized is only what's cognized. There's no you there, you're neither here nor there, which is, like I was saying earlier today, of you're not trying to manage something that hasn't happened yet, and you're not trying to fix something that's already happened. You're here where life is occurring.
Yeah.
Where what is seen is only what is seen. What is heard is only what is heard. What is cognized is only what is cognized. It's not out and out and out, projecting yourself, your view of self, out, forward or back. So that's really, I love this sutta. This is really cool.
I do too. Thank you for that. What you're avoiding the need to attach a view of self onto what's occurring. You know, another way of saying what Matt just said. We're simply present. This points to the entire purpose of the Dhamma. And I would bet you if I read this sutta and this sutta was told to me, well, this is the entire Buddhist teaching. I'm going to go follow something else because that doesn't sound like much to me. But when you understand it in the proper context, it is the key to lasting peace and happiness. To be present, to not be here or not be there. You know, to not spend my first 15 years of life dreaming to be center field for the Yankees. You know, or anything else, any of the other distractions that I lived in. Everybody lives their lives with. To simply be at peace with what's occurring, to be present with it. Let me continue. These are still my words. In Dhamma practice, as dispassionate mindfulness develops, the distraction of the physical world and the distraction of our own individual stress and unhappiness is understood as the same distraction. So it's the common distractions of the world and our own internal distractions are exactly the same distraction. Is that clear? And I'm not playing games here, and I'm not saying that the distractions of the world are a external projection. The distractions of the world are our distractions. If we're attaching a self-referential view to it. If we're insisting that something be different than what's occurring, it's then a distraction. We're not seeing what is seen. The ego personality's need... I'm sorry? What'd you say?
She said good stuff.
Oh. Thank you for your enthusiasm. That's important too. No, I mean, enthusiasm is part of right effort. You know, and the root of enthusiasm is enthos. It means to be inspired. You know, enthusiasm is good, a good aspect of the Eightfold Path. The ego personality's need for the people and events of the phenomenal world to be different than they appear to be is a distraction of stress. Of course, you heard me say often that the Buddha could have nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth as saying there is distraction as stating that there is dukkha. Because it's the preoccupation with dukkha that creates the common distraction or the ongoing distraction for our entire lives. When we can resolve internally the problem of dukkha, we're no longer distracted. We're able to be present with what's occurring. It is a distraction of stress that leads to mindlessness and maintains stress and unhappiness and the confusion of the ego personality. It is the very first teaching when the Buddha set the wheel of truth in motion that he describes the truth of all stress and unhappiness. Now this, monks, is a noble truth of stress, disappointment, unhappiness, and suffering. You heard me say this over and over again, but I'll say it again. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, grief, and despair are all stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. We've all had that experience. Separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. And you heard me talk about that often. Tuesday Sutta will connect that a little bit closer too. And also the talk on Saturday, the Kaya Yanagata Sutta, relates emptiness to the five clinging aggregates. And I just posted that on the website too. As a consequence of being born in the world, we are all subject to stress arising from impermanence and clinging. The five clinging aggregates describe the mental and physical components of the ego personality in the phenomenal world. This is a noble truth in that it transcends time. It was true at the time of the Buddha and is true today. In describing the noble truth of stress, the Buddha is teaching to see clearly and with dispassion that these experiences are inevitable and are to be understood as impermanent manifestations of not-self or the ego personality. Stress arises from the ego personality wanting these and all other experiences to be different than they are. The ego personality is what has taken form through the five clinging aggregates. And we talk about that a lot. By putting aside all views of self, by letting go of the attachment to the ego personality, no views are left to influence the experience of the present moment. Clear vision and right view then define our experience. This is mindfulness of the Buddha's Dhamma. Wholehearted practice of shamatha vipassana meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path is what the Buddha taught to develop dispassionate mindfulness, free of the ego personality's discriminating and discursive views. Shortly after Bahia's encounter with the Buddha and his enlightenment, this is an important part, and this is usually people laugh at this. I don't know why, but you can if you want to. I know why. Just kidding. I'm getting back into the sutta again. Shortly after Bahia's encounter with the Buddha and his enlightenment, he was attacked and killed by a cow. See, some people laugh. You're laughing at the irony of it. Bahia was so concerned that he's going to die soon, I better learn the Dhamma right now. He was right. He got attacked by a cow. The Buddha, upon hearing of Bahia's death, instructed some monks to retrieve the body, to cremate it, and to cremate it properly, and to prepare a memorial to Bahia. When completed, the monks, knowing Bahia's awakening, asked the Buddha what Bahia's future state would be. In other words, the monks want to know, okay, now Bahia's awakened, where does he go now? Much like what was asked before, what happens after you awaken? Monks, Bahia was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma, I love this line, and did not pester me with issues not related to the Dhamma. Again, think about Vajragoda, or think about our other maybe silly questions about what happens to me after I awaken. He wasn't pestered by those silly questions.
None to ask him what emptiness is.
Well, yeah. Did not pester with issues not related to Dhamma. Bahia, monks, is totally unbound. Meaning, by using that word, he's saying Bahia has awakened. Then he continues, where water, earth, fire, and wind have no fitting. Now, he's relating those four elements to us, to the physical form that we have. Water, earth, fire, and wind. That's the five elements, the four elements. And the Buddha often used that as a metaphor for just a normal human being.
I have a question.
Yes.
And they said they were going to make a memorial for him. That has a context today of focusing on someone that is past. And so what does it mean in this context?
In this context, it was just what they did when a person died. And there was nothing special around it. It was, in fact, you could say that it was more part of their health system than a ritual.
Well, so they cremated him.
Yes.
But I think he said cremation or proper burial and memorial.
Yeah.
So I wondered.
Yeah, and again, in just simple and direct terms, remember that a human being has passed and he awakened.
So it's all part of the same sort of ceremony, ritual event.
Yes, but not making anything special about it. It was something done. In fact, I'm going to get into something I probably shouldn't with the time, but it was just a common practice. They weren't doing anything special for him. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, meaning that there's no establishment of self-referential views. They have no footing. There the stars don't shine, the sun is invisible. So again, the Buddha's not describing some bleak existence after awakening. He's simply saying that there's no longer a self that is embedded in the world through self-referential views. The star is not shining, the sun's not shining, etc. There the moon doesn't appear. There darkness is not found. Now he's talking, again, relating this back to the a human life that is prone to dukkha. There's nothing left to give rise to that in the world anymore. And when a sage, a Brahmin, through great wisdom and discernment, has realized this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. But he was right to understand the immediacy of needing to awaken through the Dhamma. No one can know when sickness, aging, and death will arise, and this is why the Buddha gave these final instructions moments before he himself passed. And this is a great way to kind of end the talk, too. Impermanence and decay are inevitable. Work diligently for your own salvation. Those are the last things the Buddha ever said. And I think about that, how important that is. He could have said anything. He said, it said he's given over 84,000 teachings over his career. He could have reinforced the Four Noble Truths, but there was no reason to do that. Impermanence and decay are relentless. Work diligently for your own salvation. It's up to us to do it. That's in a sutta called the Maha... I can't think of the name of the sutta. Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the last sutta of the Buddha's teachings. And it encompasses about 90 days, the last 3 months of the Buddha's life. Just prior to this, Ananda was begging the Buddha, knowing that the Buddha's about to pass, please give us your last teaching. I need to know, what are we going to do now? And the Buddha said, I am not like a teacher with a closed fist. I've held nothing back. I've given you everything you need. Then he said this, impermanence and decay are relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Take to the Dhamma. He's already presented these teachings. There's nothing else left for him to do. In fact, there's references earlier in this sutta, one of these days I'll give a talk on it, that he knew he was about to pass. And you could say that, you know, he was prophetic in that, but he just knew he was old and it's, you know, time is coming up. He doesn't have much time left. And he prepared the other monks, but he continually came back to, you've got this teaching. You have your Sangha. You have everything you need. Take refuge in that. You don't need me anymore, in other words, is what he's saying. You don't need the Buddha here in your life. In fact, I can read between the lines, and maybe I'm speculating, but I think the Buddha is now seeing himself as being too relied on for understanding, becoming more of a substitute, becoming more of a person to be worshipped rather than to follow what they taught. And I'm not saying that's why the Buddha died, but I think he understood that when you read some of the other things that he said. And he knew that, of course, about Ananda. Remember, Ananda was with the Buddha for every teaching he gave for the last 25 years of his life. He was the Buddha's attendant and his cousin, etc. But yet he didn't awaken until a month after the Buddha passed. And part of it had to do, I think, with this last things that the Buddha said to him. You got to do it yourself. Strive diligently for your own awakening. So, any questions about the Bahiya Sutta? Just remember the words. They're simple words. You know, when there is seen, there is only what is seen. When there is heard, there's only what is heard. When there is cognized, there's only what is cognized. When there is sense, there's only what is sensed. Another way of saying that is recognize when you're caught up in the world and you can feel tension in your body or stress in your body, remind yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And just see clearly what's there. And in every occasion, you'll see the impermanence, no matter what it is, no matter how intense it might feel at the moment, you'll be able to see the impermanence and your stress will start subsiding. And then what you're feeling is something that's appropriate to feel because it's not reactive anymore. Great sutta, wasn't it? I love it.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.